From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The seas are so vast, we tend to think our impact on them is recent. It's not. It's old and it's deep. So deep that the seas of poetry and history may be gone, maybe forever. This hour on Point, we look at the long, deep human wake in the sea, back to the great age of sail. You can join us on air, online, fishermen, sailors, marine biologists, what's out there now. Join us anytime, digitally, at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The conversation here never ends. We will hear in this hour about how CO2 emissions are breeding giant super crabs in the Chesapeake Bay, but first, the really big picture over time. W. Jeffrey Bolster joins us from Durham, New Hampshire, a longtime master mariner and now professor of history at the University of New Hampshire, author of The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of the Sail, which just won the Bancroft Prize for History. Jeff Bolster, congratulations and welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
What a wonderful kind of terrible story at the same time. All this human endeavor and investment of sweat and love and poetry and everything else in the sea. You remind us, though, that our heavy hand on the seas goes very far back, and it's nothing like new, Jeff.
Yeah, that's sure the case, Tom. You know, people were making an impact on the sea using technology that we would not even consider technology. So the book really focuses on impact during the age of sails and oars, hooks and lines and handheld harpoons, and it's pretty sobering.
How far back do you go? And when, I mean, surely there was a you're going back centuries, I know, and there was a time when these were little wooden boats, and even the sails weren't very big. Surely there was a time over the many centuries you cover when man would look out and woman on board as well over those seas and see something that justifiably, that reasonably looked unconquerable.
Indeed. And obviously much of poetry and literature and scripture through time has invoked the idea of the eternal sea, the implacable sea, the unforgiving sea, the old prayer, "Oh God, thy sea is so great and my boat is so small," encapsulates that. And yet I go back, start really telling the story at the end of the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, looking at the changing nature, the depleted nature of European coastal ecosystems, and digging further into why Europeans sailed across that tempestuous Atlantic to the, quote, New World. It was in large part because local supplies of fish and whales had already largely been depleted with the technology that they had available to them at the time.
Your real focus is in the North and Western Atlantic, sort of New England and North, across these great fishing grounds. Right off the bat in your prologue, you've got a wonderful passage where you take us back into that age of sail and give us a little sense of what it was like to be out on these waters when they were mind-bogglingly abundant. I wonder if you might read a bit of that for us.
Yeah, I could read that passage. On clear, dry days in the age of sail, with fish coming over the rail, the coast of northern New England and Atlantic Canada could charm the most hardened fishermen. Green-capped islands and barren, dark rocks, each girt round by waterline stripes of living white barnacles, infringed with mustard-hued bladder wrack, protruded from waters teeming with life. Offshore, dainty petrels skim the surface, plucking tiny invertebrates from the sea, while white gannets with six-foot wingspans plunged into the schools of baitfish on which cod thrived. Vast armies of porpoises, the horsemen of the sea, arced across the surface like cavalry rolling across a plain. And every cod yanked unceremoniously from the hook had, as fishermen said, a coin in its mouth. Still, when the wind veered to the northeast and the sky closed with the sea, the stunning productivity of that ecosystem came with a price.
W. Jeffrey Bolster, reading from his Bancroft Prize-winning The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of Sail. It's a beautifully written history. You also have spent a lot of time at sea yourself, a decade and more, captaining, master mariner, and all the rest. Have you witnessed this sea, the sea that you described right there? Is it already, and maybe for some time now, only in the pages of history that we read that hyperabundant sea's visage?
Tom, I've certainly seen abundance. I think I've never seen, of course, the kind of unfathomable abundance that was once there, because it's just gone now. But I'm almost 60, and it's getting to be the point that that my own data points go back 50 years now, and I've certainly seen changes here in the waters of coastal New England, some for the worse, some occasionally for the better. And I just took a boat to the West Indies from Thanksgiving to Christmas, sailed down from Maine to the Caribbean, and I spent much of my 20s in the Caribbean, and I can tell you I again saw changes there. The introduction of an invasive species, the lionfish that was never there before, a resurgence of green turtles. So in other words, the sea is a dynamic environment. All ecosystems are always in flux. The ocean is never constant, although much of myth and history and literature and some older science thought it was sort of at equilibrium. We know now that change is constant, and unfortunately what we've seen is a lot of changes that have been human-induced that are not speaking well to the future of the vibrant living ocean producing goods and services on which people rely.
It's become so evident that people really worry about it now, but you remind us that century after century, generation after generation, the fishermen, the people on the seas, they saw this chunking down of its superabundance, and they worried about it, not just in this century, but in previous centuries. They were very aware of the impact that they were making. How did they describe first the lushness? And maybe that was so lush that, you know, century after century it first looked that way. But give us some examples of how they saw it moving from that abundance to something less over time.
You know, Tom, before the American Revolution, people in coastal New Hampshire and Massachusetts were writing to their legislatures, these are the provincial legislatures, mm-hmm. and lamenting the depletion of shad and alewives and salmon. Those are the anadromous fish that live in the ocean but come up the rivers to spawn and have their babies. New Englanders before the Revolution lamented the decline of the coastal whale fishery because, unfortunately, they had killed most of the right whales that swam close to the shore when colonists first arrived here. So what we have is clear documented evidence of depletions in coastal inshore estuarine ecosystems by the time of George Washington's presidency. If you bump ahead to the 1850s and 60s, that's the first time that there's ever systematic, concentrated evidence and examples from fishermen in New England and Canada, as well as those in Europe, making the point to their elected officials, government officials, that true sea fish, cod and herring or scup or mackerel or menhaden, fish that don't come up the rivers, they were in trouble. And so, unfortunately, the most sobering aspect of this book that I've written is mm-hmm. that we as a society have been having the very same conversations from the 1850s and 60s to this day about depleted oceanic resources and what are we going to do about them. In the meantime, we as a society have continued to fish and fish and make the problem worse. So the discussion's the same, but the baselines each decade get lower and lower of what remains in the living ocean.
The pattern you describe here is one of fishermen witnessing, seeing the depletion that's going on. At a certain point by the 19th century, you know, looking for help to slow down that depletion or reverse it, but being pushed by economics to adopt new technologies that, in the event, just actually deepen the depletion, speed it, make it worse.
Yeah, Tom, you've put your finger on the tragedy. The tragedy is that for much of this period, it was fishermen and fishing communities that protested vigorously about what was happening, and they use terms like depletion, degradation, diminution, these are 19th century terms, to petition their legislators, both at the state and federal level and at the provincial level in Canada, to do something. It was fishermen who understood that this watery world on which they relied was changing and not for the better. And it was scientists for a long time in the 19th and early 20th century who said, oh, no, everything's fine. Nature produces in inscrutable ways and we'll develop better technology and it'll be fine. Now, in our lifetime, you and I have heard the discussion where it's scientists who are saying, we've got a problem here. We need to fish less. And it's often the fishing industry who says, no, everything's mm-hmm. fine. So the point is, the terms of the debate have been similar since the Civil War. The sides have switched, but the kind of language they use and the concepts they use is the same. But the bigger question, of course, in the face of this tragedy is, does it matter who's saying what? Because for the most part, the ongoing depletions have continued.
We're going to look back at that history. The title of your book makes the stakes seem just about as high and radical as they could be. I mean, the mortal sea. You're talking about something like ocean death there. What do you mean to suggest with that title?
Tom, in 2003, there was a scientific paper published in the journal Nature, a very high-end journal. Mm-hmm. And that paper explained that in the estimation of those authors, 90% of the world's large predatory fish, the big carnivores, which are typically the fish we like to eat, are gone. So that's 10 years ago. Newsweek magazine followed up on that, popularized it by in a July 2003 issue of Newsweek. The cover story said, "Are the oceans dying?" Very simple question. Picture of a hammerhead shark. Encapsulating it that way, framing it that way, "Are the oceans dying?" sort of asked a question that for many people would have been historically impossible. What do you mean, can the oceans die? The oceans are almost beyond nature. The oceans are inscrutable. They're vast. They're beyond the shore, literally. And so our generation, needs to grapple with the fact that the living ocean is mortal. It's complicated. It works in many different ways, but human impacts have been very dramatic through time, and human impacts can continue to be worse or less worse as we go forward.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Lighthouse Foghorn there at Owl's Head, the coast of Maine. We're talking about four centuries of fishing the Atlantic this hour, and the story of how little humans humbled a great ocean, starting with little wooden ships at sea. W. Jeffrey Bolster is with us. He is author of The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of Sail. It just won the Bancroft Prize. Columbia University gives that out for books on diplomacy and history of the Americas. It is a wonderful book with a sobering moral that our depletion of the seas goes way, way back, and we've been more conscious of it than we might have collectively acknowledged over that time. Jeffrey Bolster joins us from Durham, New Hampshire, and it's great to have him right here. You quote Rachel Carson, and it's striking because you quote her from 1951, and of course she wrote Silent Spring, about as environmentally aware, we think of her, as anybody in that time. And you quote her saying, "Mankind cannot control or change the ocean, as in his brief tenancy of earth he has subdued and plundered the continents." How could she get it so wrong? Someone so aware.
It's a great question, Tom. You know, by the end of her life, she had revised her opinion about that statement. But she wrote that in, I think, 1951. She was trained as a marine biologist. She'd worked in Woods Hole. She'd worked mm-hmm. at Beaufort, North Carolina. She was first and foremost a marine biologist, and her first books were actually about the ocean, wonderful lyrical books. But she did get it wrong initially, until late in her life, because the combined heft of tradition and literature and science had suggested that people couldn't make a mark. Now, the irony, the profound irony that runs through my book, like the ley line in a length of a rope, mm-hmm. is that fishermen had been speaking about these problems not just for decades when Carson wrote, but for centuries. And so there's something always about humans that we hear what we want to hear, we imagine as we want to imagine things. And the mythological impact that the ocean was eternal and immortal and couldn't be changed by humans could even influence someone like Carson, even though for centuries fishermen had saying, "Hey, we got a problem here."
Put us out there on those seas across time. You read for us, and it's almost literary in the beauty of your description there. But through the eyes of those fishermen, seafaring people over the centuries, put us there. Help us see the hyperabundance that they experienced. Help us feel the losses that they felt. Give us a few examples of that, if you would, Jeff.
You can start in medieval Europe, where the great fishery of medieval Europe was the herring fishery. Herring were eaten as commonly in medieval Europe as hamburgers are in America mm-hmm. today. And so the herring were caught by not big modern factory ships, but by little tiny inshore boats for centuries, just catching herring, especially when they congregated in the straits between Sweden and Denmark. They were easy to catch then. And then the Dutch developed some small herring boats to go offshore into the North Sea. Again, following the migration of herring, their annual migration around the North Sea. There was a Swedish cleric at the time, late Middle Ages, or Renaissance really, who wrote, "The fish are so abundant here, you could stick an axe into the schools of fish and it would stand upright."
Oh.
Now that's in Europe. But at the very same time that he's writing this, European fishermen are recognizing that many of the other species they're pursuing, such as the bottom fish like cod, are actually growing thinner in supply. And so Europeans come across to the Americas, mm-hmm. and again, they use that very same language. And we get people like Captain John Smith of Pocahontas fame,
sure.
the great New England explorer, entrepreneur. And he writes around 1620 that whereas the fisheries in Europe are decayed, that's his word, mm-hmm. fisheries in Europe are decayed, here in New England, they are fresh and beyond belief. And he's encouraging Europeans to come over. Now, by our standards, Tom, it wasn't like late medieval Renaissance European seas had no fish left. But with the technology available to people at the time, they had taken the low-hanging fruit.
Right.
And so it was easier for them to come across the North Atlantic
all the way, yeah.
and spend a season fishing here
yeah.
in Newfoundland or New England or whatever to then go back instead of trying to use the simple technology at their disposal to get more out of those somewhat depleted ecosystems at home. And so this is the pattern that we see going forward. Fishermen always have two choices. When catches go down, you can either develop new technology that fishes more intensively, or you can take the gear you have and get in your boat and sail to a place that has not yet been exploited. And so the move to America for well over a century, there was nothing about like freedom of religion. It was let's find fish and whales. For more than a century, Europeans were not even thinking of settling here. This was just the Western Ocean. It wasn't the Atlantic, the barrier to the New World. It's just an extension of the fishing grounds. And they came seasonally, caught fish, killed whales, killed seabirds for bait, and went home again. So that's a very different story. And I try to frame the book in the beginning thinking historically about the ocean, not just as a barrier, but as a player in the drama and how perceptions of it changed and how its productivity changed through time as well.
And a player long before the Pilgrims. I mean, this was sojourn
yeah.
being made.
Right.
I know some of that area, and you write about it as well. John Smith, he was in the Isle of Shoals or Star
mm-hmm.
Island up
yep.
there off New Hampshire.
Yep.
I know that well. When they first came into that zone, what did they encounter? What did they see on these wonderful fishing banks, you know, that you can see on the map? What did they experience there? And where did they begin to see the first hits to the ecosystem, to the stocks,
yeah.
George's Bank and Brown's and all the way up to Grand Bank?
It's a great question, Tom. When Europeans arrived here, English and some French in Canada initially, what was so striking is that this ecosystem here was just the same as the one at home. It's a boreal North Atlantic ecosystem in between the Arctic and more temperate zones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's a boreal system like you have in a boreal forest. In other words, the species are the same. The seaweeds or the kelps are similar. The seals are similar. The fish, herring, salmon, cod are similar. The ducks are similar.
Europeans felt at home.
They felt right at home.
Mm-hmm.
When they went to the Caribbean or to the Straits of Magellan or to the Philippines, it was wildly different, and they wrote about how different it was. But when they got here—
Crazy-looking lobsters, you know, see lobsters
exactly.
without claws. And all.
You know, Magellan's men go to the mm-hmm. Philippines, and they see chambered nautilus, and they see mm-hmm. clams that mm-hmm. are, you know, giant clams that are 30, 40 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Columbus goes to the Caribbean. He sees fish of many colors, the likes of which we've never seen before. But when Europeans arrived here, Newfoundland, Gulf of St. Lawrence, Gulf of Maine, it was all the same stuff,
mm-hmm.
ho-hum. But there was a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And they were mind-boggled not by anything that was strange or bizarre, except for horseshoe crabs. They'd never seen horseshoe
mm-hmm.
crabs. But they were boggled by the abundances. And these were mariners. Mariners are only alive if they pay attention to their surroundings. These men were often the best and brightest in their generation. They had paid attention to their surroundings in Europe, because
yes.
that's what you do when you're sailing a boat.
And you stay alive that way.
And they come over here, and it's like, it's all the same stuff, but there's a lot more of it. So what we really have here is these Renaissance seafarers that we think of as the explorers who arrived here, they were looking at a marine system the likes of which had been seen by Neolithic people in Europe. That's the transition from hunting-gathering to settled life, because that's what was now occurring in the Americas, transition from Native Americans hunting and gathering to now these European settlements. They were looking at a system that looked like European seas had looked like thousands of years before. So that was a telling moment.
What are the first hits to that you found in the record? What were they describing as that was there and then was gone?
The first hits are always the anadromous fish. The anadromous fish are ones like salmon, sturgeon, shad, alewives that come up the rivers to spawn. And Europeans knew that this had happened in Europe already. We know through fishbone analyses in archaeological digs in Poland and in England and the lowlands, the Netherlands, that the size of sturgeon had been getting smaller and smaller and smaller through the Middle Ages because they were being overfished. We know that in England, these great fishing machines, fish traps, fish weirs, littered the rivers so that the spawning fish could not ascend. So it's all the first ones to go are always the easy ones. And so the dramatic one around here that went first would be the Atlantic sturgeon. They can get to be 14, 15, 16 feet long, huge fish.
Wow.
And they're armored. They have these scutes, they're called, the interlocking plates on the. They have very, very few predators in the wild once they've gotten to some degree of maturity. But they're big fish. They're slow to grow. They're slow to get to sexual maturity. Mm-hmm. They had an evolutionary strategy, which is to come up the rivers into relative safety to have their babies. Well, as they were hit by fishermen who didn't really need any sophisticated gear to take them because the fish swam conveniently to the dooryard, that's one of the first hits.
Mm-hmm. Yep. 14, 16-foot sturgeon gone.
I mean, the Merrimack River here was once called the Sturgeon River, and as late as the 1760s, it still appeared on some maps as the Sturgeon River, even though a New Hampshire fisherman who was an inveterate diarist kept a diary there at the falls for years, the Ambuscade Falls that are now Manchester, and when a sturgeon was caught in 1760, he marveled at it because it had been so long. So
sturgeon, salmon at the shore, up the rivers, take us out to sea and where the hits began to appear.
Again, by the 1850s and 60s, we have fishermen complaining about depletion of codfish. Now, this just strikes us as bizarre. You know, because we think that the depleted fisheries are really an artifact of post-World War II, of polyester nets and electronic fish finders and pinpoint precision navigation systems. But I've been part of a research group at the University of New Hampshire for the last 12 years, an interdisciplinary group with ecologists, biostatisticians, historians. We've been working to try to use documentary records to ask questions about ocean's past. And one piece of our research that the group published some papers on had to do with cod biomass on the continental shelf off Nova Scotia in the 1850s. We had a vast run of American customs house records, fisheries records, where American boats from the North Shore of Boston were fishing on the south shore of Nova Scotia, but in the sea, in the banks there. So we were able to show that during that time, it's the last gasp of the Little Ice Age, it's the 1850s, that cod landings on that vast area went down dramatically, precipitously, basically 50%. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time in which fishermen are noticing that landings of a deep sea species like cod are dramatically declining, and they're complaining. And what we have is by 1873, Spencer Baird, who is the director of the U.S. Fish Commission, says, well, restoring salmon is important, but it's of trifling importance compared to the restoration of our exhausted cod fisheries. Now, that's 1873.
And a level of cod fishery that we would be overwhelmed to have today. You write, the bar keeps getting moved and always down.
Exactly, Tom. That's the shifting baseline syndrome. When Spencer Baird wrote that, the landings just from the Gulf of Maine were about 70,000 metric tons of cod each year. In recent years, it's been more like 3,000, 5,000 metric tons.
Wow.
And he wrote that at a time when fishermen in Maine and Massachusetts were complaining bitterly to their legislators that that the good times were gone. Now, they were landing 16,000 fish a season from these small inshore boats, which any fishermen today would be delighted to have, and yet they thought it was already pooched. And so that that is the example of the shifting baseline syndrome, which is that each generation comes upon a situation which they regard as sort of normal, and then they claim it's getting worse through their time. What they don't understand is how much worse it had gotten in the previous generations before they arrived on the scene.
Which takes us to some pretty cosmic questions, and we will get there. Lots of callers for you. Alan in Chesapeake, Virginia. You're on the air with Jeff Bolster. Alan, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I like hearing about the New England, but coming from Chesapeake, Virginia, just outside of Norfolk, Virginia, the
yes.
world's largest naval base.
Yes, sir.
John Smith had written about the oysters in the bay being the size of turkey serving plates you'd use at Thanksgiving, 2 feet across.
Wow.
And this is at a time when thousands of people, several tribes, Pamunkey, Mattapani, Algonquin, Powhatan, had been fishing the rivers for centuries.
Yes.
So it's really not the fishing, but the overfishing. And as big and mighty as the ocean is, apparently man is bigger. And I'm surprised that I'm glad people can look at a mountain or the ocean and see it as powerful and perhaps never changing. But global warming has changed the temperature of the ocean and the climate. If we've changed the planet, please know that the ocean has changed as well. And, the oysters are gone. Well, sorry, a lot of them are gone. Hopefully there'll be something about the CO2 content, and now that's making the crabs bigger, although Chesapeake Bay crabs are not quite as plentiful. And the quality of the water in the Chesapeake Bay has changed from the way it was in 1607, 1640. And people were writing about that in the late 90s, 1690, 1710.
Alan, your antenna for the sea are very good right there in Chesapeake, and I really appreciate your calling in, reminding us of that description and the bigger picture. As big as the ocean is, man turns out to be bigger. 2-foot oysters long gone, Jeffrey, wherever you want to find them.
Yeah, the caller makes some great points, Tom. I mean, human impact on the sea right now in our era, we know that ocean acidification is going on. This is part of global warming, but it's increasingly difficult for some organisms in the sea as the pH changes to create their silica exoskeletons. We know that pollution is going on. It's not just oil pollution, but it can be chemical pollution or pollution in a variety of different ways. Invasive species, ships are transporting from the Chesapeake Bay to elsewhere. Jellyfish, the great catastrophe in the Black Sea about 15 to 20 years ago, was ballast water from the Chesapeake Bay taking jellyfish, introducing them into a foreign ecosystem where they devoured all of the plankton and larval fish and largely stripped out the Black Sea of its life. So we have a variety of habitat degradation. There's about 5 major impacts on the sea right now that humans are doing. My book really only addresses the overfishing piece because my book, while it goes back to the Viking Age, it really concentrates on that period for the 4 centuries that were the long wind-up to industrialized fishing. So it ends about World War I. I figured that most people today understood that in recent days we'd made a hit, so I wanted to show how things were changing much farther back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about 4 centuries, maybe more, of fishing the Atlantic and the story of how little humans humbled the great ocean, starting with little wooden ships at sea. W. Jeffrey Bolster tells it beautifully in his big new history, The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of the Sail. We're going to look in just a moment at the super crabs coming up along the shore as CO2 pours out of our power plants and more. A couple of calls right here. Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Camille, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I live by Lake Michigan, and I've lived in California, too.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're out at the water, what you see is its beauty and its power. And for the most part, all of its problems are hidden by its beauty.
Yeah.
And what I'm wondering is, because I'm one of those people who believe that a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Yeah.
What have you thought about what it would take to launch a campaign to visually represent these problems that the oceans and the lakes are having. You know, whether it's using modern technology and representing things visually, or using photographs of coral or whatever it would be.
Let us see it. Let us put it right before our eyes, you're saying, Camille.
Yes, exactly.
Let me pick it up with Jeffrey Bolster. What are we? I guess we are so literal, so visual, Jeff.
No, Camille's got a great idea. Many people have talked about this through time. I ended the final chapter of the book by trying to paint a picture and suggest that had underwater photography been available around World War I, what would we have seen differently? I contrasted that with what we could see on the surface vis-a-vis vessels and gear. Camille has put her finger on an issue, which is this. Most of the representations of the living ocean that we see in the media, television, film, whatever, are the beautiful ones. It's the brightly colored fish. It's the sunlight filtering through the water. It's the waving fronds of kelp, the whales, whatever. What we don't see, because it's sort of ugly, is ravaged ocean ecosystems have been destroyed by trawling, broken coral, dying coral, whatever. And so part of this, again, is just in this media age in which we live, where producers typically want beautiful images, the actual picture of what has happened in the ocean has never really, there's a few exceptions of some good films, but never really been presented in the way that we continue to see pictures of startling beauty.
And we're sort of living in the past, almost deliberately, as kind of deliberate delusion almost.
Yeah, well, you know, we see what we like, or producers of these images feel that funders and viewers and all don't want the downer. But the honest to God truth is that, as Camille pointed out, the surface of the sea looks unchanging. That's where part of this metaphor of the sea as eternal came from. But for a long time, we've been fishing with gear that's extraordinarily destructive. I mean, a little piece from the book that speaks to this is the otter trawl revolution, the bottom dragging revolution that came in about a century ago. All the fishermen in Gloucester oppose it. The mayor of Boston, that was Jack Kennedy's grandfather, opposed it.
Outrageous, brutal,
and they said if it's happened in Europe and it's ruined the system, if we do it here, it's going to kill all the fish. And yet, Congress appointed a subcommittee. They studied it, blah, blah, blah. The legislation never passed. And so these changes came in. But I think one could make a wonderful documentary, hope all the funders are listening, about how to depict visually these changes in the sea, because Camille has put her finger on a powerful, powerful story.
And yet we turn sort of hungrily to those beautiful images. We don't get enough of them. Martha's Vineyard calling in. Michael on Martha's Vineyard. Thanks for calling, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi.
My
point of view is visual, although I'm a swimmer and a good one. I've done distance. The sea is changing, not for the better. We have to try to be informed and hold back to hold on to what is there instead of watching it fall away. If you are able to see the coral of Cuba and the sea life there, it is superior. And the coral life anywhere else on the planet, according to my source, is hurt. It's gray. It's not as lifelike. So also the sea life there, we need to take better care, and it may cost us, but if you can compare in your mind what it is like to know the beauty of the ocean that was there, then you have something to go on. Simply to proceed day to day, you may not get the insight.
Michael, you're right on the island. You see it firsthand, and I appreciate your call very much. Thanks for that. Let me get one more from the shore of Salem, Connecticut. Bob, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'd like to say is I'm a lifelong fisherman, worked professionally as a biologist for many, many years, and I've seen the destruction of the ocean in the Northeast. I've actually seen three disappearances of striped bass, which is one of our more important species. The big one, which you guess really never even mentioned other than passing in the herring family, is menhaden. That's a species that there's a really neat book by a guy named Bruce Franklin called The Most Important Fish in the Sea.
And in fairness, fish. Jeff pays a lot of attention to it as well, yes.
Yeah, they fish. I'm sure he's read the book and just didn't mention it or whatever. If he hasn't, he should, because the menhaden is the one that feeds everything. This is like almost like the algae. It's like a step above the algae. They're a filter feeder. So they take the algae that's in the ocean and all the invertebrates and all that, convert it into fish flesh, that literally every other fish that I know of, and one of my claims to fame, I'm an outdoor writer, is I've been skunked fishing for everything. You know, it's that's kind of a funny thing, but it's true. I've tried fishing for about everything you can think of, from, you know, New York up to Maine, Canada.
And what have you seen with menhaden, Bob?
The menhaden population, when I was I used to work for the DEP and used to do a visual survey, get up in a small plane, a Cessna, get a certificate of waiver so we could fly at 500 feet. I could count boats, and I could actually see if they were fishing or just sitting on anchor and party.
Yeah.
And one of the things that in those days, when I flew the Connecticut coast, you know, 90-some miles of the Connecticut coast, there was a time back in the early 70s when you could not look down literally from a plane and not see, like, they looked like shadows on the ground, schools of menhaden, okay? Now, I bet if you went up and flew the whole Connecticut coast, you'd be lucky if you found four or five small schools. I mean, there was times when the whole Saugatuck River all the way out into the islands, the Norwalk River out into the Norwalk Islands, was literally dark. And you can tell when it's fish because you can occasionally, from that height, see the flashes when they're swimming.
Yeah, you know? Sure. Glinting. Bob, I appreciate your call. I mean, Jeff, there it is. If we imagine this over centuries, Bob and you've seen it in your lifetimes. Multiply that by all these centuries, you start to get the idea.
Well, I pay a lot of attention to menhaden in the book. Bob is spot on about their importance in the system. But here's the point. When he was seeing that, my experience, I grew up in Long Island Sound, started fishing in those Norwalk Islands, know the Connecticut coast pretty well. When he was seeing it from that spotter plane in the 70s, the system was already significantly depleted.
Sure.
And we had the first huge menhaden crash on the East Coast as a result of the fishery in 1879. That's a century before Bob was up there. And the point is that observers then talked about a sea captain going into Portland, Maine in the early 19th century, going through a school of menhaden that was 40 miles long and 2 miles wide.
Wow.
A biologist standing on Montauk Point at the end of Long Island saying the entire ocean around the point was purple. A fisheries biologist pointing out that at one time a beach seine said in New Haven Harbor, that's you take a little net out from the beach in a rowboat, you encircle a school of fish, they caught 1,300,000 menhaden in one haul of the seine. Now, the point is that by the late 19th century, those once vast swarms had been reduced. Now, they rise and fall, but Bob, your caller, was absolutely spot on. Menhaden are such an important fish. Bruce Franklin's book, The Most Important Fish in the Sea, points that they not only provide forage or feed for larger, more noble creatures, but they also do in the water column what oysters do in the bottom, which is that they filter feed and they cleanse the water. They let the light go through. So in many ways, we have to ask ourselves as a national interest, is it more important for us to have menhaden in the system or for us as a society to take them out of the system and turn them into fish oil and fish meal? There's a raging controversy about this right now. But again, when we realize the first three words in the Constitution are we the people, and that we the people have ownership of various resources, whether it's grazing land or minerals or
not
fish.
Not we the menhaden.
What ultimately is in the best interest of the nation vis-a-vis those? If we're talking about trying to restore coastal ecosystems for both commercial, recreational, aesthetic purposes, it might be a better idea to leave some of those fish in the sea.
It just might. Jeff, stand by. Justin Baker Reese joins us right now from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He got our attention recently, the story we saw in the Washington Post about the dawn of the super crab. This post writing that crabs, talk about, this is not loss, but a sort of weird growth. Crabs bulking up on carbon pollution that comes out of power plants and factories and vehicles, settles in the oceans, turning these crustaceans into even more fearsome predators. Justin Baker Reese, thank you very much for being with us. What's the bulking up? What's going on?
Well, maybe I could provide a little bit of background about the study first. There's this process known as ocean acidification. where humans were releasing unprecedented amounts of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. A lot of that goes into the atmosphere, but a lot of it goes into the oceans. And when it does, it forms carbonic acid, which lowers the pH of seawater, causing it to acidify, hence the term ocean acidification.
Sure.
Now, a lot of organisms in the sea, corals, clams, crabs, a lot of them build their shells from a mineral known as calcium carbonate. And this mineral is just on the edge of dissolving in the oceans. Mm-hmm. So there's concern that with this CO2-driven acidification will push the oceans to dissolving this important mineral that a lot of organisms use for protection on the seafloor. So what we did was we conducted a series of experiments where we wanted to investigate exactly what the impact of this acidification is on marine calcifiers. And we looked at about 18 different species. And what we saw was very surprising. A lot of them had a negative response to the acidification, but a few, such as crabs, lobsters, and shrimp, appeared to have a positive response. That is, they calcified more quickly under the more acidic conditions, probably because there was more carbon in the water for them to use to build their shells.
So it weakens the shells of oysters, but it makes crabs grow big.
Right. That's the idea. The oysters had a more negative response because they have less control over the calcification. The crabs, which are more sophisticated, can exploit that elevated carbon despite the increased acidity. But that only answered one part of the problem. It only showed us what individual species-level responses were. And the next step, we wanted to see how this translated up to the ecosystem level and to more complex relationships between organisms. So that led to a study by a student in our department, Luke Dodd at UNC, who's working with Mike Piller in our department and Jonathan Grabowski at Northeastern University, where we looked at how the high CO2 levels affected the relationship between crabs and oysters when they're together. So Luke grew these crabs and oysters under the high CO2 conditions like before, but then he put them together after growing for several months under those conditions.
What happens to the ecosystem in that case?
Exactly, and you know, figure out how that impacted the predator-prey dynamics. And what we expected to see was to see the super crabs, as people are describing them, feeding more voraciously and effectively on these weakened oysters. But what we saw was quite different indeed. What we saw was that under the high CO2 conditions, despite being stronger and bulkier, the crabs fed much less efficiently. They
were sluggish.
They were sluggish. They had longer handling times. That means it took them longer to open the crab up. And they consumed fewer oysters under highly controlled experiments.
So if we have more acidification to come, where does that take us, Justin? We're talking about changes over time here with Jeffrey Bolster. What do you see on the crab front?
Well, I think these studies really highlight the complexity of the issues at hand here. So on an individual level, organisms respond different ways. We know that from the first set of experiments and from a lot of other work being done on the subject. But from this new generation of experiments looking at things at the ecosystem level, species interactions, the relationship is more complex and appears to be more negative than when you're looking at individual organisms. That is, the crabs calcified more quickly, but their behavior was impaired under high CO2 conditions. And we think that's attributable to a process known as hypercapnia, where increased CO2 levels in the ocean essentially displace oxygen in the crab's bloodstream, which is akin to confusing them. It's the same thing that happens when we hold our breath. We get dizzy, confused, disoriented because the carbon dioxide builds up in our blood. We think the same thing might be happening to the crabs. Despite
great. Think about the whole sea. I mean, you talk about a mortal sea, Jeff Bolster. There we've got a species kind of holding their breath. Jeff, you say it's hard for us even to bear in mind what the baseline once was. People talk about restoring the seas, and then the question is, well, restore them to what?
Right.
What about this relationship? Is just headed down the tubes?
No. Justin's study puts its microscope on the two most important sort of signature creatures in recent history in the Chesapeake Bay, the oyster and the crab. Mm-hmm. And he points out in a powerful way how the ocean is not constant or eternal, but it's in a state of flux. Right now we believe that human activities are increasing certain dynamics in the ocean in ways that might not be positive. But his point is that it's in constant change. You know, I think the point, the high concept behind my book is that without historical perspectives, we can have no idea of the magnitude of the restoration challenges we face. Not to say that humans have a very good track record of engineering the outcomes in nature that they desire, But without historical perspective, we have no idea of the magnitude of these restoration challenges. In other words, it's most data sets that are used by fisheries managers are very short duration.
Do you still believe in restoration after you look at centuries of essentially downhill motion?
You know, Tom, I'm not saying it's going to be easy, and it certainly is not going to occur in a political cycle of 2 years or 4 years mm-hmm. or two political cycles of 8 years. You know, we're talking about centuries of degradation. The alternative to restoration is catastrophic. Jonathan Yardley wrote a great review of my book in the Washington Post because he said anyone who thinks this book is only about fish is living in a fool's paradise. You know, take your cue. It's really about human impacts on ecosystems through very long time. That's what I tried to do in the book.
The water and the land, they're all the earth, and the picture that you paint over that huge swath of time is a very arresting one indeed. Justin Baker Reese at University of North Carolina's Aquarium Research Center. Justin, thank you for joining us for a few minutes today.
Thanks for having me on the show, Tom.
And W. Jeffrey Bolster, author of The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of the Sail. We are grateful for that long perspective, that long view. Jeff, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.